I don't know. Good morning. Good morning. Dr. Jeff McDonald said in the first service that if you're here today, you get double credit. So your money will be waiting for you. No way. That's a joke. How are you? If you missed a happy hour last night, we had a good time. It was a good group. A lot of fun. Great. We ended up settling all the things you ever wanted to know about James Bond. It was great. So would you make sure, let me just underline what Diane said about Easter. There is probably no finer religious theater in Houston than St. Paul's on Easter Sunday. And regardless of what you believe or don't believe, the Easter services are spectacular. And the clergy, but particularly the choir, put in incredible work in that time. And they sing three services, 8, 9:30, 11. And between those services, they're tired, they're in a bad mood or whatever. Anyway, they need food. And the Candlelighters class here for years has provided that food. Before the big remodel, it was in what was called the basement of the sanctuary building. I now refer to that as the grounded floor. Because of those of us who are down there, are grounded humans. So we have it in the youth center now. And they used to prepare the food, and have it available, and there would be stuffed eggs and various things. And I think a couple of years ago, the Candlelighters class is made up of older people, and they're doing what older people do. They die. And so there are not as many of them left. And we've been asked if we would step in and take that over. And I hope we would. We can buy food and take it. And I think we've done that past. If you want to do that, that's great. But if you actually would like to prepare something and bring it and even hang out down there and visit with people, it's a great social event on Easter Sunday morning, believe it or not. You can go down there and hang out with the choir and the clergy, and it's a great thing to do. So I hope we will do that. Okay. And next Sunday, pardon me, I hope to have an announcement about what comes out of the strategic planning committee meeting that we're going to have in the back room immediately after this class today. So would you make sure that your phone is off? And no matter who you are or where you are on your spiritual journey, you are celebrated here. And let's begin in silence. And may grace be in our heads and in our thinking. May grace be in our eyes and in our seeing. May grace be in our ears and in our hearing. May grace be in my mouth and in my speaking today. And may grace be in our hearts and in our understanding. And may grace be at our ends and our departing. Amen. By stating that being here can be hazardous. And I mean that. If you are open to the content that's offered in ordinary life, it stands the risk of moving you from one developmental level to another. And that is risky. That changes and can change a lot. Being a pastor in a church is also hazardous, especially if one in the conducting of worship services is foolish enough to make a children's sermon part of the service. Over the years, I have collected and have promised to write a book about children's sermons and open mic gaffes created by clergy. I have some doozies. You know, all clergy now wear a mic, a wireless mic, to amplify the sound of the voice as well as to go out to people who are live streaming, and sometimes we forget to turn the mic off and then go back into the sacristy and say things that shouldn't be said. And but right up there is the risk of doing children's sermons. I'm going to collect a book. I've got three children's sermons I'm going to tell you about. And I swear to you, I would swear this in the court of law, these are true stories. Now, I'm assuming that you know what a children's sermon is. If not, a children's sermon is that part of the service when the minister takes leave of his or her senses and invites a group of kids to come to the chancel steps and sit and join the minister. And usually the minister says some sweet little story to these urchins based on what the sermon is allegedly to be about. That's the idea of the children's sermon, so that kids get to feel that they're including it in the worship service. And when this is over, usually the kids go away to another thing or they stay in the worship service, but they will have been satisfied that they've gotten something directed at them in the worship service, okay? Now, in case you've not already picked up on it, I think children's sermons are really, really bad ideas. I'm going to tell you three reasons why. All these are true. These happened to friends of mine. A buddy of mine, clergy inherit worship services, okay? The worship service that you get is what has been done in the church for a long time. And when you change that, there's heaven to pay, or the other part. So this particular Sunday, the sermon was going to be about prayer. And the minister invited all the children down to talk about prayer. And he said to them that it's important for us to pray for people, to pray for everybody, but to particularly pray for people in need. Like, for example, if somebody was in the hospital facing surgery, we would want to pray for them. Do any of you know anybody who's in the hospital getting ready for surgery? One little girl stuck her hand up, and my friend, who thought he knew what was going on with his congregation, was not aware that this little girl knew somebody in the hospital. So he said, who's in the hospital? And she said, my mommy's going to have surgery. And he was really put back because he didn't know he had to go have surgery. So he held the mic in front of the little girl. What kind of surgery? A boob job? True story. And you don't recover from that. That's what I mean. Ministry is hazardous to your health. When Sherry and I first got together, we had a couple that we hung out with. I would have described them at the time as our best couple friends, Wayne and Linda McCluskey. I can say their names because they're both now deceased. Unfortunately, they died very, very young, early. Actually, Wayne McCluskey long before we met him, and maybe before he and Linda were married, was on the staff of this church, as minister of youth. His father was a DS in the Methodist Church. We got really bonded with these people. We spent some time with them every week for years. And then they up and moved to Seattle. And so that instigated our going to Seattle every year to spend time with them. And then we would meet them in other places in the country to share Thanksgiving holiday, for example. When they moved to Seattle, because Wayne has the same credentials as I do, psychology, and he's a minister, he got connected to the University Church in Seattle. He was active with the university students there. And occasionally he would fill in the sermon of this church for the University Methodist Church in Seattle, Washington. Big church, nice church, sophisticated congregation. So the Sunday that Wayne was asked to preach, the lectionary was about, the gospel selection was about Jesus' teaching in parables. And Wayne thought that a good way to teach the children about parables would be to make a comparison between a parable and a riddle. So he got the children down, and he said, today's gospel selection says that Jesus taught in parables. How many of you know what a parable is? Of course, kids don't raise their hands, which is what he was counting on. And then he said, a parable is very much like a riddle. How many of you know what a riddle is? No hands went up. Wayne said, well, the first riddle I can remember hearing is, what is black and white and red all over? I was going to make a slide of that, but you can't do that. Because if you spell the word, it doesn't work, right? What is black and white and red all over? No hands went up. Wayne is brave. But, you know, bravery can move into stupidity if you wait too long, and he waited too long. So finally, one little girl held her hand up and said, more like a question than an answer, what is black and white and red all over? Is it two nuns in a chainsaw fight? True story. Wayne said the congregation never recovered. That there were these explosions of laughter and titters all through the rest of the service, like popcorn going off in a can, you know. And finally, he came to his senses and said, the closing hymn is, and they sang a hymn and went home. True story. I think that may be the best children's sermon story I know, except the next one. And this happened to a seminary classmate of mine whose name is Glenn. Glenn is still alive. Glenn graduated from seminary and got a plum of a church in a suburb outside of Atlanta, Georgia. And again, he inherited a worship service, and worship service had a children's sermon. And Glenn was doing a series of sermons on the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, I don't know if you've read the book of Ecclesiastes, but it's probably the most normal book in the Bible, certainly in the Hebrew scriptures. Read it and you will see. It tells about the human condition. And it's full of wisdom and so forth. So Glenn was teaching, going to preach a sermon on the importance of saving. Not just saving money, but saving values, saving the environment, saving all sorts of things. So he got the kids down, and he started talking to them about saving. And the way he began was, how many of you get an allowance? And all the kids held their hands up. And then he said, what do you do with your allowance? And they said, some of them said, well, they spend it on lunch money for school, or they save it to buy a toy, or some said they give it to the church. That's kind of a required answer. But he wanted to talk to them about frugality in all areas, and he said, I'm thinking of an animal. He said, really not an animal, but that's what he said. I'm thinking about an animal that lives in a tree, has a bushy tail, and stores nuts. How many of you know what that animal is? Finally, one little boy held his hand up, and Glenn stuck the mic in front of him, and he said, I know the answer is Jesus, but it sounds like a squirrel. And that, my friends, is an example of how the church teaches people what to see and not how to see. The expected answer was Jesus, contrary to what common sense told the kid was the truth. So, in this moving into the sacred stream, you may know that I'm trying to hit three themes. Learning more about Jesus, learning more about ourselves, and learning more about what it means to participate in cosmic evolution. And today I'm going to begin focusing specifically on gaining clarity about who Jesus was, what he taught. And in the process, we'll talk about those other two things as well, but that's the primary emphasis today about Jesus. You know, interest in knowing who Jesus was as a figure of history and what he might actually have said and done was never questioned until the middle of the 19th century. It was taken for granted. And the reason for that is, recalling what we talked about earlier, the world participated in a mythological state of consciousness. And then there was this guy, David Frederick Strauss, who decided to take on the task of figuring out if he could, looking at the manuscripts and the historical data that was available to him, who Jesus was, what Jesus said, and what Jesus did. Caused a firestorm in scholarship. Didn't make it into the church's awareness. What David Frederick Strauss did is now referred to as the first quest for the historical Jesus. Now, the reason he gets that title is that two generations after this guy, another man by the name of Albert Schweitzer, whom you've all heard of, took this task on again, and he wrote a book called The Quest for the Historical Jesus. So that book got labeled the second quest. Frederick Strauss gets the first quest. And then the third quest for the historical Jesus began with what we talked about last Sunday in the beginning of the work of the Jesus Seminar and people like Stephen Mitchell did. Okay, so you've got three specific times in history when people have been interested in the historical Jesus. Now, three of the most visible people in the most recent quest for the historical Jesus are people that you've heard of, because I've talked about them a lot. And they've also been three people who have spoken from this very spot. That would be Marcus Borg, Shelby Spong, and John Dominic Crossan. They're just three visible people. There are hundreds of scholars who have devoted themselves to this particular work. These are just the most visible. I'm sure you're aware of it, but right down the street that way, in the medical center, there are researchers who are doing work in cancer research, and they are finding cures for cancer. They are finding cures for leukemia. The cure rate is going up like that. You're aware of that. Scholarship, because it makes it into the news. You're aware of discoveries that are being made by the James Webb Telescope, because that makes the news too. And you can go on NASA website and you can look at those images of the James Webb Telescope. They're beautiful. In a similar manner, there is ongoing work, discovery being done in archaeology, linguistics, manuscripts that are being discovered, all that sort of stuff having to do with Jesus, who Jesus, that time in history. But it doesn't get reported very much, and sadly, it doesn't make it to the curriculum of most churches. But that kind of work is being done all the time, being reported in scholarly journals, and it's the kind of thing that I find just really, really fascinating. Now, I've decided, because I've done it before, that I'm going to approach this material this time around a little bit differently. I'm going to deal with it as it comes up. And you'll see what I mean by that in a minute. So if I say something, which I'm going to do today, like Jesus said or Jesus never said, I hope you will trust me enough to know that I'm basing what I'm saying on that scholarship that I just mentioned that's going on. I'm not making this stuff up. Even though these are slightly dated, if you're interested in the Marcus Borg's books on reading the Bible again for the first time and meeting Jesus again for the first time, if you're new to this kind of material, these books are very important. If you know what I'm talking about, you don't need to read those. Part of what it means to grow up is to be willing to step out from under the shade of whatever worldview we grew up with, inherited in our youth, and learn to see the world as it is. And if we see a squirrel, to call it a squirrel and not call it Jesus. Okay? We've got to develop the courage to say that. Now, I don't know about you, but I grew up in a culture that professed goodwill toward all, taught God loves all the little children of the world. But it was a world that also that had separate water fountains, entrances, restrooms, restaurants, accommodations for whites on the one hand and colored people on the other, as they called. And those are what some people now refer to as the good old days. Memory is deceptive. And the comfort that many in our culture now long for was an ignorance that kept them safe with fixed categories of belief and behavior where Jesus was the answer that they gave, but a squirrel was a reality. It's only when we transcend the values of tribalism that we stand a chance of experiencing any renewal. Now, everybody's got to pick a road to travel. I'm suggesting the one that we can discover by doing historical, critical research into Jesus. So let me quickly remind you of the cognitive levels that Jim Marion has in his book, The Death of the Mystic God, Mythic God. This is an important book. And I just want to stress again, these levels that Jim Marion talks about are cognitive developmental levels. They're not emotional levels. They're not spiritual levels. They're how we use our brain, okay? Because they're different ways of understanding this. The work that Strauss, Borg, Crossan, other people have done in studying about Jesus has all been done at the rational conscious level. This is the level at which science works. The people who oppose this oppose it from the mythic consciousness level. People who teach what comes at the rational logic level, like me, are striving to move us to these three levels. Vision logic level is where I think most of us are. But I just want to say there are two levels beyond that that are scary as heaven. I'm serious. There are two levels beyond that, and they frighten us to move into them because it's just like moving from mythic to rational when you make that move. If you remember what that was like, that was really terrifying, okay? But there's more to do. So Jesus was a real person in history. Scholars say now he was born probably about 4 BC. Sometime in his young life, he left home. The best theory that we have is that he joined up with John the Baptist. And at some point, Jesus left John to begin his own teaching ministry. We are getting into the Easter season. In 2 weeks, it will be Palm Sunday. And usually during Holy Week, on CNN or PBS or on the History Channel, they show these shows about who was Jesus, what happened at the crucifixion. You've seen shows like that, right, that are on. One of the guys who's on that show is a guy that I think really is, I don't know him. I know him personally, but I don't know him closely. He's Bruce Chilton. Bruce is really a really fine guy. He's an Episcopal priest. He is one of this nation's living great biblical scholars. And he's written a bunch of books. This is just off the website of Bruce Chilton. And this book, Rabbi Jesus, I highly recommend. It reads like a novel, but it tells a story based on what contemporary scholarship can tell us about who Jesus was, how he grew up, how he left John, how he lived, what life is like. It's really, really wonderful. I think it's one of the best books I've read. So the early followers of Jesus created a bunch of stories about him. Birth stories are one. The story of his going into the wilderness is a creation by the early church. Most hero stories begin with a hero going into some challenging thing. And in the wilderness experience, Jesus is confronted by the devil. Now, the devil is a mythological figure that we all know. Everybody in here knows what it's like when the devil gets in you. Don't you? Okay. But it's not the only one. The word devil comes from a word diabolical, which means to split. So Jesus has an encounter with splitness, and he comes out with non-dual. Jesus goes into the wilderness and is challenged at every hand by saying, if you think you are who you say you are, then, and Jesus counters with some way of saying, I am who I say I am, but I won't play your game. He comes out of that experience and begins his teaching, which is not diabolical, not divisive, not split, but non-dual. Richard Rohr says Jesus is the first non-dual teacher in the West. One. He teaches one. And so he comes out with his teaching that says, I am not God, but I'm not other than God either. Okay? Now, in the Roman Empire at that time, that was heresy. because who was God? The Savior of the world, Prince of Peace, was Caesar. And Jesus said, not only am I one with God, but and it gets worse or better, so are you. Now, there were some people who heard that message as good news. That's what gospel means. And there were some people who said, you can't say that. But Jesus kept saying it and kept doing it, and so they executed him. That clear what I'm saying? I have this meme that shows Jesus in the typical Jesus thing, saying, okay, everyone, now listen carefully. I don't want to end up with four different versions of this. That never happened. What Jesus came out of the wilderness saying was, I've got some really good news, and in order for you to hear it, you have to change your level of consciousness. That's what the word repent means. Repent means change your mind. Now, this change is hazardous. If you change your worldview, everything around you is going to change. You're going to start seeing squirrels and calling them as such. I don't think we need to be angry or ashamed about what we believed at one point. I'm certainly grateful for the church in which I grew. It taught me the Bible. But leaving that behind, knowing that my well-being depended on leaving that world behind, was extremely difficult. But it did teach me a basic lesson, and that is that nothing lasts. I learned, among other things, that love your neighbor as yourself, which my church taught me, was not a command. It's a description of the way life is. We, in fact, do love others as we love ourselves. And I also learned that cognitive and spiritual growth aren't matters of how certain one is, but matters of how open one can be to the future. It's a matter of resonance. Is this right for me? Does it fit? Is it fair? Is it just to everybody? In the database of Jesus' sayings, I don't find him saying anywhere I came that you might be comfortable. So as you know, we are in a time of deep change, and some people are dismissive of this by saying, well, we've always been in a time of deep change, and that's true. Everything arises and falls away, nothing lasts, but we are in a time of deep change. Climate crises and the crises caused by climate crises have never in recorded history, been what they are today. Human migration, caused in part by these crises and in part by human evil, has never been on the scale it is today. Now, my belief, and this is what I'm teaching in ordinary life, and you just have to pick whether you want to pick this up or not. I'm not telling you what to believe. You've got to see the squirrel for yourself. But my belief is that we will move through this change more easily if we get real clear about what road we are attempting to travel, if we have a clear idea of the destination toward which we are moving, and if we have some understanding of who is making the journey. So that covers all three of those things. Jesus, self, evolutionary biology, cosmology, in all three of those things. Now, I want to move in this sacred stream with the most up-to-date knowledge I can have. Just like when I go to a doctor, I want that doctor to treat me with the most current, up-to-date scientific information that person has to treat me. And I want to keep those values in front of us of joy, freedom, love, and I would say fearless joy. I want to do a brief excursion here, if it's okay. I'm going to do it whether it's okay or not. One of the principles of ordinary life I came up with a number of years ago is that we have a moral obligation to be happy. And nothing I have ever said, I don't think, has gotten as much pushback as that. I still believe we have a moral obligation to be happy, but you can't make yourself happy. The desire to be happy and the feeling of unhappiness are the same. Does that make sense? If I want to be happy, I'm affirming that at the moment I'm not. Okay. Tricky. So happiness is not something we seek. Happiness is rather something we become. Now, the desire for perpetual happiness isn't all bad. It accounts for why we have been so innovative and enjoy many of the benefits that we enjoy in society. let me put that in a little bit starker way. We are all barreling towards certain death. Aren't you glad you came? And it's the hunger to enjoy as many pleasures as we can in that process before we get to certain death that makes life as enjoyable as it is. So the constant feeling of lack has in fact caused us to have more. That's not all bad. Cures for cancer are driven by pain and suffering. But the happiness that I'm referring to is a byproduct of doing things that are challenging, meaningful, beautiful, and worthwhile. The fact that all of my most important teachers were smiling all the time is why I made that moral obligation to be happy part of the principles of ordinary life. It's not a matter of chasing what feels good. It is a matter of doing what is loving and honest and freeing and enjoying the byproduct of that. It's a matter of how you look at things. Some people look at the work of the Jesus Seminar, for example, and they're terrified. Shouldn't be doing that. Others look and have learned, though it meant the pain and comfort associated with putting another worldview aside, that it was an experience of incredible joy and an enormous benefit to see things we hadn't seen before. Now, the teachings of Jesus were greeted exactly that way. Some people went, wow, and some people went, no. So how do we tell the difference between Jesus and a squirrel? That is to say, how do we put down mythic understandings of and beliefs about Jesus and move into a hopefully more vision logic, even beyond vision logic, level of consciousness? How do we do that? How do we know who Jesus really was and what Jesus really said? Now, I'm going through Stephen Mitchell's version of the Jesus narrative. There are others, but this is the one I'm choosing to do at the moment. So I'm going to try to answer that question. How do we know what Jesus really said and did? And the honest answer is, we don't. Now, if you have a revealed theology, what I just said is heresy. Because there are people who are sure that they know what Jesus said and what Jesus did, but we don't. We got some ideas. The fact is that there are no indisputable facts of history. We know certain things happened in the past, but that's not the same as knowing what happened. We know, for example, that on 9/11, 2001, some planes flew into the World Trade Center. We know the fact that that happened. But that fact means different things to different people. Depends on what country you're from, what your values are, whether you had loved ones in the towers or not. Now, if you move further back, even before we had mechanical recording devices, it's more difficult to know what happened. History is constructed. The history of this country was written by white male colonizers. What if it had been written by indigenous native people? We'd have a different history. Talk about the same thing, but different history. So I'm going to do my best to present a picture of what scholars refer to as the Jesus of history. I just want to be clear that what I'm teaching is in no way the real Jesus, because the real Jesus is not available to us. Okay. Just like when I die, I'm not going to be available to anybody. Stories about me will be. When you die, you won't be available. Stories about you will be. We were talking last night about writing obituaries. Go ahead and write your own now so you'll get it just exactly right. You want to be remembered, get that ego out there and inflated and whatever. I have a buddy who was diagnosed with a fatal illness a number of years ago, and he wrote his obituary. And since then, he's told me that he's rewritten it like 12 times, and it gets shorter every time. Up until the time of Strauss, the understanding of Jesus was at the mythic level. But since the advent of rational consciousness, the picture of Jesus that has emerged is not some person from heaven, but rather a person who directly challenged hearers to a new understanding of two things, God and themselves. What he said comforted and transformed some people and really ticked some other people off. It was not a consistent response. So I'm saying we have to pick a path. The path I've chosen, the one I want to learn about and teach, is the way Jesus taught and lived. And since you're here, I'm assuming that's true for you too. So I really would like, I think, to be affected in the dramatic way that people who became saints were affected by Jesus. I'm scared of that, frankly. I've got people who are teachers of mine that I look at them and I envy them and I'm grateful for them. And I can say, I'm not sure I would pay the price to be where you are. Just want to be honest with myself about that. Jesus himself, not the person, but the story about Jesus underwent a dramatic transformation at the Council of Nicaea. So that today the Jesus of before Nicaea would not recognize the Jesus after Nicaea. He wouldn't, who is that you're talking about? So Jesus was a Jew. You're aware of the rise of anti-Semitism in the world today? Jews have been the most hated people throughout history. He was poor, None of us wants to be poor. The level of his education remains an object of debate among scholars. He did not end his life with a retirement party, rewards ceremony. He was executed as a common criminal, hideous death. To boot, Jesus was a Galilean Jew. A Galilean Jew was hated by the Judean Jews more than Samaritans. He was born, we don't like to talk about this in church, out of wedlock. That is one of the reasons that scholars hypothesize that he emphasized forgiveness so much and God as Father. God as nurturing Father. He was a man who lived without bitterness. He lived with compassion for everybody, except for people who didn't have compassion for people. All he got in return was hatred and abuse. Yet he himself seems totally free from prejudice and bigotry, even though he was the recipient of it all his life. His life did not end with his execution. He lived on in the lives of the people who embraced him, who shared his understanding of forgiveness and love and compassion and joy, and who, no matter how they mixed it up with each other, still were able to come back and share a meal with each other every week. That's the key. We've reduced that into a bite of bread and a sip of grape juice. So I want to say six things about the character of Jesus and what he taught. And these will be very brief because we're going to be talking about these things in the weeks ahead. First of all, Jesus was a wisdom teacher. He was not concerned with theories of sin and salvation. He was not concerned with rules of how to live, how to get it right, how to behave. What he was concerned with was, how do you cope with life as it is? And he met people where they were. He was a healer. That there were healers in the world at that time is without dispute. We'll soon be dealing with a healing episode from the ministry of Jesus. There are many. If you go through the Gospel of Mark, which we're not going to do that one, but you've got these 13 episodes of Mark of healing, speech, sight, lameness, paralysis, leprosy, so forth. These are metaphors too. I'm not saying there weren't real healings. One of the things I think that the church could learn from Jesus was his, and from other saints as well. I'm thinking now, this isn't in my notes, but about St. Francis. He touched people physically. He touched people. We're wary of doing that. And you remember the story of St. Francis jumping off his horse and kissing a leper. And we don't like that. Jesus taught an ethic of trust. Our world is one of fear. Turn on the TV. Something to be afraid of. Our ethic is not trust. Ours is, you've heard it, the Protestant work ethic. We all inherited it. You earn your way in worth. Fourth, Jesus taught universal kinship. Now, you're probably aware there has been an ongoing great debate from the very beginning about what Jesus meant by what has been translated either the kingdom of God or the kingdom of heaven. Scholars are now mostly agreed that what Jesus meant was the kinship of people. Jesus invited people into a community where they were empowered to experience and then live out the life that he taught. A community of empowerment. In a time of tribal culture, which we are reverting to, this was radical stuff. Love your enemies. Probably the second most radical of Jesus' teachings. unless you go to his most radical teaching, was let your enemy love you. That's what the parable of the Good Samaritan is about. A good Samaritan was such an oxymoron in the time of Jesus. So Jesus actually taught the breaking of ties that bound people into frightening competing communities that allowed them to be in a different kind of community. And fifth, Jesus' teachings are marked by celebration and joy. He taught with humor and irony. He was what we would call a social deviant. I think of Jesus as kind of a stand-up comic. He said these just outlandish things that left people scratching their heads and whatever. He's a funny guy to me. And he was a person of integrity. That goes. So if you're wondering what is the practical application of this, just look at the list. Look at that list. We need people like this in the world. Now, what I'm teaching is not new. It began with Strauss. It's picked up speed over time. When Stephen Mitchell's book hit the market, 1994, when the Jesus Seminar people really gained traction, people didn't like it. I turned to this teaching this material right after 9/11 because I saw how dangerous and destructive Christian fundamentalism, which is now called Christian nationalism, and it is taken over, is the result of stupidity and ignorance. And after a talk that I gave in here one Sunday, a guy came up to me and gave me his exit speech by saying that you ought to stay away from this Jesus Seminar material and preach the gospel. People need to believe in Jesus. My response to him was and is, my friend, that is exactly what I'm doing. This is preaching Jesus. And people need people like this in the world. People need wisdom, which includes information and knowledge, but it also includes understanding. In the beginning, following Jesus wasn't about believing anything. It was about loving. It was about living in loving relationships, living in forgiving, accepting, inclusive relationships. Now the church is all about division. When did that shift occur? And why? And trust is about moving into the future without being scared witless. We don't have to hang on to the mythic statements of the early church as literal truths. Those people, they struggled to make sense of the world just as we are struggling to make sense of the world. Their statements were provisional. So will be ours. Hopefully, there will be another level of consciousness that will look back on our level of consciousness and say, can you believe they really believed that back in? Further, let's celebrate the joy that there's nothing to fear in uncovering the roots of our tradition. We follow the truth of fighting a rearguard action is not trust. And perhaps the most important thing on this list is integrity. That's the relevance of Jesus. Taking personal responsibility for life and living for the living of our lives, for life in general, that's hard for people at mythic level consciousness. They want somebody else to be in charge, which opens the door to tyrants. The The God of Jesus refuses to come to the rescue. Remember Jesus' teaching, it rains on the just and the unjust. We have to take responsibility for ourselves. We have to take responsibility for our planet. Now, if we stay at the mythic level and try to do that, that's like putting a billy goat in charge of a garden. We have to move up. So I want to give you my current statement of faith. It changes from time to time. If you borrow it, if you want to, if it's useful to you. I believe that by living by the teachings of Jesus, we can be healed. Ruby Sales says that if you really want to connect with somebody, ask them where they hurt. We all do, about something. We're all scared about something. Healing has to do with dealing with that and trust and the faith that there's wholeness to be aimed for. The healing lies in trusting that it's both okay for us to go forward and to live as Jesus did, loving all others as the relatives that we are, and to celebrate life to the hilt, to live with joy. And maybe it is knowing that we have a moral obligation to do these things. Maybe even a moral obligation to be happy. You know, Jon Stewart is back on TV. Have you seen him? He's on The Daily Show once a week on Monday nights now. And I got out of a habit of watching The Daily Show when he quit. But I love the way the show ends. The show ends every week with, here's your moment of sin. You know, you've seen it. So here's your moment of sin. Most people that you meet need somebody to be Jesus to them. And maybe even more importantly, in our society right now, there are so many people who need Jesus to be in their behalf. No matter where you go this week, no matter what happens, remember this, you carry precious cargo. So watch your step and see you here next week. Thank you.